One, two, three, four.
Oftentimes we look at creative work as though the very creative process itself is something good. These are tools of expression. And like any tool, you can use it to damage something or to make something. So I wanted to do this set of books to show what is kind of the basic DNA that people use, for good or for ill. What are the tools they use, if you like, of expression that they use in the creative process?
Over the last five decades, Richard Sennett has written about social life in cities, changes in labor, and social history. His books include The Hidden Injuries of Class, The Fall of Public Man, The Corrosion of Character, The Culture of the New Capitalism, The Craftsman, and Building and Dwelling. Sennett has advised the United Nations on urban issues for the past 30 years and currently serves as a member of the UN Committee on Urban Initiatives. He is a centennial professor of sociology at the London School of Economics and a former university professor of humanities at New York University. His latest book is The Performer, Art, Life, and Politics. Richard Sennett, welcome to the Creative Process and One Planet podcast.
Hello. Well, I'm very glad to join you.
Yes. So you wrote The Performer, Art, Life, and Politics. You wrote near the beginning, if I live long enough, I'll write three essays on the presence of art.
You're reminding me of something so painful, which is I have two more books to write on this subject.
So just to summarize for our listeners, you'll write these essays on the presence of art inside society, this one on performing and another on narrating and a third on picturing. And in your view, these three run the gamut of expression in human beings. They constitute our expressive DNA and distinctive. Reading a story and watching it dramatized on stage or film, they're different. But the ethical connection is stronger than the medium. All three can harm as well as inspire. Can you expand upon those themes?
Well, oftentimes we look at creative work as though the very creative process itself is something good. And we've got to break that habit. These are tools of expression. And like any tool, you can use it to damage something or to make something. And so I've been very mindful of, even in the art I know best, which is classical music, which seems harmless, if nothing else, that it can be turned to very malign purposes, for instance, in the operas of Wagner. So I wanted to do this set of books, and I interrupted you because who knows whether I'll live long enough to do them, to show what is kind of the basic DNA that people use, for good or for ill. What are the tools they use, if you like, of expression that they use in the creative process?
Yes, and you concentrate, well, on so many things, but really on this as a stage, the cities as a stage for performance, as a living, like, work of art, and really broaden our conception of what is a performance. Like, we think about politics as being a performance, but also public protest as being a kind of choreography. And these relationships, I feel lucky. Now, I know you're now in London, but you've lived in the great cities of the world as well, in New York and Chicago. And I feel lucky to be in Paris, and Patrick, who will join us in the conversation shortly, is in Amsterdam.
The best city.
Well, for all these public performances, for the walkability, or we call it the 15-minute city, there are places where you can understand the performance. Not everyone is lucky to live in those kind of cities. So, I mean, what turned you on to this idea of, we know your background, I would love to hear about your background being a cellist, but the soundscape of the city and how it's alive. A lot of people don't think of it. They think of it as inert in some way.
Right. Well, this is not an original idea to me. That for a long time, ever since the Renaissance, in fact, people have thought about cities, the design of cities, as works of art. That's mostly about their imagery, their physical spaces, and so on. The notion that there's spaces where people are performing for each other in everyday life is a more recent one. It comes out of Baudelaire in the 19th century, a little out of Balzac. And it asks a question, which I try and take up in my book, which is, well, sure, people are on display to each other all the time in and they're, performing roles. What's special about performance once you go into a theater, into a music hall? And that's not just a question about where you are, it's about what's happening. If you saw somebody doing Batu on the street, a ballet dancer, you might think great, but you'd also think sort of this is sort of weird. But the moment you see somebody making those steps inside a theater, it becomes a whole different kind of experience, expressive experience. So in my book, I try to understand what it is that makes this transformation from the street to the stage. It's not all the same sort of thing. Again, it's the same thing with sound. We don't listen very hard on the street, except for sirens. But even that, we sort of block all that out. But the moment you get into a concert hall, even somebody coughing in a classical concert can disturb you. And in a rock concert, somebody who's, not paying attention to what's going on the stage can make you very angry. So, again, there are different kinds. Something happens to the nature of expression when it becomes a creative process rather than just something that's an everyday form of communicating with other people.
Yeah, you have to make space for them, that anticipation. And, it's so strange. My last interview yesterday was with Joan Lanier, who they some call him
Oh,
the.
my friend.
Yes.
He's a very good musician, by the way.
Yes. Have you performed with him? I didn't know.
No.
So, yeah, he's wonderful. I mean, a musician, and also some call him the, for those who don't know, the father of virtual reality. And so
Is.
it's so interesting because I don't think of him as being a virtual person, but it's very irresistible. The digital spaces, the virtual worlds where, he has a kind of utopia vision of what that could be, but that's taking us away from what you're talking about, this embodied experience where you do have to make space for others. And it's with great sadness. I mean, we see its effects and in politics and all these things where everyone is just talking at once and not listening. And so in your vision, I'd like to go to some of your previous books. You're also the author of The Fall of Public Man, Flesh and Stone, The Corrosion of Character, and The Craftsman. These are all address other parts, the art of the satisfaction of spending time with a craft, not as much the performance of it, or not as much the sharing of it, the public dissemination of it.
A couple of things about that. Actually, there is no art without craft. And there's a kind of direct line in my brain between the book that I wrote on craftsmanship and the book on performance. The difference is that a lot of craftsmanship is self-referential. That is, if you do a good job and you know it yourself, that's satisfying. Whereas in performing, this is something I'm convinced of, a lot of other performers aren't, that just rehearsing by yourself, just playing for yourself, is not enough. Now, that may be because I'm a real ham. I like to get out on stage and, lots of applause and all of that. It is a very peculiar kind of craft because, as all actors know, for instance, there is a craft to relating to the public, hearing their silences, reacting to all the clues to things people can't see from an audience, and so on. That's also part of the craft of performing. It's interesting about Jaron Lanier because he's got the tech, he's a real artist, and he's got the technical skills to make fabulous virtual performances. But he likes performing all those instruments in the flesh. And one of the reasons for that is that the risk level of performing live is very different than the risk level of using any of these computer technologies for performance. I once gave a performance of the Janáček quartets where there was a lot of coughing and where we made some glitches. And it was amazing to me that in the recording studio, the kind of editing work, that all disappeared. And in a certain way, it was false because the actual event that produced it was something that had limits, and it had a kind of higher risk level, which gets into the bones of performance, really stimulating. So one of the issues about craft, just to come back to that, that we have in the performing arts is where the limits on getting things absolutely right have to end, you know, because digitally we can lie, whereas a craft of performing live is something in which the imperfections are built in. They're part of the expression, you know. Even something like memory slips, which in my old age I'm now subject to. You know, when you have a memory slip in a live performance, you've got to cover it over. And sometimes you do something quite interesting to cover over the fact you've forgotten what the score is. And that's something that, say, a woodworker wouldn't want to do. They would want something where it's absolutely what it is. There's no artifice that's put over it. Things aren't just good enough, they're right, which is a kind of aspect of craftsmanship that gets in our way as performers. Anyhow, the other side of my book is, which you mentioned briefly, is I'm really interested in the relation between performance and ritual. Where do those two separate? Because a prayer is a kind of performance, but we'd never call it artistic. It's collective, it's impersonal, pretty much. The same thing with singing a psalm or something like that. The idea of standing out personally is not something that's involved in ritual, whereas the marking the artist's presence is something that happens in the non-ritualized domain of performance. In this book, I try and talk about this in a scene, I don't know if you remember it, in the AIDS hospital, where the priests want to give absolution to people who are dying of AIDS. But this group of people were professional performers, and they wanted to perform instead. They didn't want absolution. They didn't want a ritual. They wanted something which was more alive, which was about them, which was they put on a performance of As You Like It in this hospital ward, which was I describe in the book. So that's an instance of this other big thing I'm interested in, which is where does a mark of the creator come in non-ritualized kinds of performance? Of course, there are all kinds of rituals on stage, for instance. You know, dressing up in those funny suits that we wear it marks a sort of difference that you're not seeing somebody who you just meet on the street, that this is a special realm. That is it's true, it's a ritual, but it's to mark the presence that art is doing something special.
It's true, we're supposed to recognize these deformities and flaws and iron them out everywhere we find them. But the irony is, our flaws, they make us human and give us individual character and add to our art.
And I also wondering, then you talk about religion, and I mean, I'm not particularly religious, but there is something that we lose by losing our connection with history and tradition, and where we all knew the same songs, or we all could be familiar with the canon of literature or of works of art. We're very decentralized now, and even more so, it's become with, you know, cities that are based around the car. You know, we're just enclosed in these bubbles where we can curate our experience to the point of not communicating with anyone who isn't like us. So, what do you miss about some of these collective rituals that we could count on a kind of common experience?
Well, I mean, people have lots of common experiences and they have them everywhere, and many of them are ritualized. The problem is whether they are good or bad. You know, if you went to a Trump rally, that's a ritualized experience, and boy, is it theatrical. But just coming back to what I was saying before, we're talking about tools, and those tools can be used by someone like Trump to do really bad things. The other issue about political performance is that you have to take in the role of the audience and the spectator in ways that you say wouldn't if you were going to a concert, which is that all that, for instance, with Trump, all of that acting out, and it's very cleverly acted out is a way of arousing anger and indeed hatred with people about subjects which aren't named. In Britain, we use the term dog whistle. And every Trump performance is a dog whistle about race. These mobilizing Americans are real race haters, a lot of them. And his performances never really mention race. But the dog whistle is there that this is something that it's really about. It's becoming more evident now that he's got power. But that's something that has to do with the audience, what it wants, what it expects, who's going to pull its trigger, who isn't, and so on. And if I had one criticism in my own book, I don't talk enough about that. I'm more interested in performers than audiences, but it's something that's really come to me since the Trump regime has opened up.
Just on that note, yeah, he has all these rituals and he has his kind of choir that re and his repetition, his communication is very interesting if you don't like it, but he uses all these theatrical, he brands things and he's really the entertainer president of our nightmares. And I just want to mention on that thing, we do have these collective experiences like that. I was sad and kind of heartened during COVID that people were happy that we all were living through an experience that they don't remember the last time. And I thought, well, yeah, I guess the World War II or the Great Wars, these were other collective experience, but it's sad that you have to have that level of suffering to bring people together. We're living in the center of the city. By 2050, they say maybe more, 75% of the world's population will be living in cities that will be required to accommodate an additional 3.1 billion people. Are we ready for those kind of transformations where you discuss like marketplaces and the public squares? But to make those kind of transitions, and I don't know if you want to talk about sustainability, but there's a lot of other rapid transitions that need to take place, like of course for housing and energy and food and waste management, just to do with climate change. How can performance and the power of the arts, this kind of collective, be used to like accelerate those kind of changes that we'll need in the face of climate change?
Well, I don't believe in any of that. That is, I think that to deal with climate crisis, we need to deal with climate change, not to make cities, to have acrobats on the street.
We can't dance our way out of this.
Yeah, exactly. And one of the dangers, I talk a lot to arts administrators who think that, not artists, but arts administrators, people who run museums or concert halls or theaters and so on. And their notion is sort of that you can dance your way out of a lot of social problems, and you can't. It's a misapplication of the arts to imagine that it can make up for social problems which need to be solved economically, or in the case of climate change, by radical redesign of cities, which has nothing to do with performance. I mean, making cities more water friendly is something that has to do with engineering. It's a technical problem. But I've gone to innumerable kind of art exhibitions about the climate crisis and the arts. And it just seems to me it's a dodge. It's just not. It is dancing your way out of water shortages. I mean, it's ridiculous.
I completely agree. And Patrick, good to see you back. I think I was speaking to Carlos Moreno behind the 15-minute city concept, or it's just the proximity that we can use fewer, we'd have to have long commutes. So these are things, but you're right. They're completely engineering problems, but they make a nice quality of life. Patrick, please.
Thank you very much, Richard. I've read and followed your work, and I've just literally finished reading this morning your fascinating work on performing. At one point, you raised the issue that power itself starts to become staged at a certain point. And therefore, one of your childhood dreams, if you like, if I may refer to 1963, a year to which you keep returning.
I can't remember.
That year seems to have a particular weight for you in Manhattan or in New York. And you bring back what for me is fascinating is the idea that something happened there in 63 where you saw high art and everydayness meeting. And then when I read through the rest of the essays, particularly your account of AIDS in New York and What you underline is a Catholic hospital, which allows kind of liberties that are almost unthinkable in other kind of similar institutions in the city. You again come back to a problem of the relationship between individual liberty and social constraint. And then in the third part, you come to the idea, it seems to me, of personal restraint and social restraint. In other words, that the accumulation of what has been happening in terms of rhetoric, and I think it is rhetorical activity from the time of what you describe as the Riefenstahl film, that we have come to a point where we can look at a Hitler-like figure and imagine it as some kind of failed entertainment.
That's a very good way to put it.
Is that?
Well, you raise a lot of issues. First, I would say about 1963, it's engraved in my mind because it was a moment in the performing arts in New York when the idea is that there could have been a kind of meeting ground between high art and popular politics, that you could perform the Bach cello suites and that had a political impact. And of course, it didn't happen that way. And in my book, I try to explain why that meeting between high art and politics and why it fell apart. If I can say about the last part of the book, I look at performing as a tool. I think it is something that has a moral consequence for the performer, which is how to be a more, how to use this power of performance more modestly. How not to become a Trump or a Trump-like figure, but to see one's ability to move out others as something that has to be a point of personal reflection, since you can obviously do so much harm. And maybe that's politics.
May I just add a point? Isn't it the case that, many people are very puzzled at the idea, could we be possibly living through a kind of late 20s, 30s again? Everybody says, of course, it cannot be the same again or whatever. But you get an idea that people around Trump are trying out how far they can mix the element of the public domain and conceal the real element of their private ambition. In other words, they're saying that politics indeed is a zone apart where anything goes that the powerful decide can go.
Well, there again, that's the person who's really on to this problem that you mentioned was Machiavelli, who always said that there was two dimensions to politics. One is a performative one, where you throw people off balance and never can, it's the way Trump behaves. You don't ever know what's going to come
Don't know next
next.
what it brings.
And then behind that, there's a lot of rationality. And in this case, pretty clear what rationally they want to do. He and Musk want to make money. They want more power. And if they can manipulate people by throwing them all off balance or in other ways by arousing them so they're focused on the performance itself, then that's something that is what they're doing. Do you remember when Musk appeared in the White House with the chainsaw?
The image.
Yeah, I saw. And this the double salutes as well.
The chainsaw was really interesting because if you watch it closely, Trump's looking at him like, oh my God, this is another way to do this. This is a prop, and he's terrified of what's going to happen. But it was a brilliant piece of theater on Musk's part because he had just only recently gotten a $400 million contract from the government. We don't discuss that. We talk about the chainsaw to get rid of government waste. And that is a very Machiavellian use of theater. It just occludes what's really happening. I don't know whether this is a repeat of Nazism. And I'll tell you why. I think it's more like a Latin American, like a Guatemalan dictatorship. Because Nazis were incredible bureaucratizers. Everything was laid down by 1935 so that you knew exactly what the rules are and who is responsible for them and so on. This is creating what we're seeing today is more like a kind of Guatemalan dictatorship. You harm the judiciary, doesn't know what to do. You disorient the legislators who don't know how to behave, and so on. You have a lot of chaos, and behind that chaos in public leaves you free to pursue what I think is just, the creation of more wealth and more power in private. So that's the story of Guatemala or El Salvador. It's not the story of Hitler.
Yeah. And on that note of theater, a theater of thuggery, I mean, we've just seen the Irish chosen ambassador for St. Patrick's Day was Conor McGregor. And we know that Trump is well liked and admires the mixed martial arts and Dana White and all this. So it's a step up. We would say that maybe Nazism, I don't like to make those easy comparisons, but had a certain aim towards high culture and, classical music with a different set of gods.
Without Jews, but yeah, I guess. I mean, I just think we're in a different kind of power relationship now, in which the bad uses of theater are really a kind of disguise. When you look at those Leni Riefenstahl films, for instance, Triumph of the Will or the one about the Olympics, they're about real events which she accurately films. There's nothing mystifying about them, These are things that actually happened just the way they're shown on film. Whereas at these Trump rallies, they're pervaded by alternative facts. The films they show could be Disney films for this kind of political versions of Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. I mean, it's a different realm. And anyhow, that's just to finish this up because I see our time is up. I mean, I think the problem for us is, in a way, it's the same problem we have in thinking about things like chemical weapons or a nuclear bomb, which is you have a very potent tool and are you going to use it well or badly? And in this case, you have a huge number of people in public, not just at the top, but are willing and more than that, who want you to use it badly, who want politics to become theater. And where are you, by the way?
I'm sitting in Amsterdam,
Ah, I
yeah,
see.
near Friedrichshain.
Oh, yeah.
Well, if I may, then a final question. You're very obviously concerned about how, in throughout all this play and all this performative, exigent material that you brilliantly denote from different domains of cultural and historical practice, you're obviously very concerned. Who am I at the end of all of this? Have I anything to say? Can I, through art, make any impact? Is there any point drawing the distinction between availability as a TV personality in the case of Trump or a real politician? I mean, do these distinctions based on identity, do they not all collapse within the world you're describing?
Well, that's a very good question. I mean, this book is a rather ironical one because the reason I focus so much on this notion about modesty and performing is that ultimately I kind of come to fear the power of art. That's for somebody trained as an artist, that's an ironical ending. I mean, I think we'd have a more humane politics if we were willing to be bored more. Do you know what I mean? All those things to read speeches rather than to listen to them. And so all of that. It is an ironical book in that sense. Maybe not so much in the musical domain, although certainly, Debussy once said about Wagner, the problem with Wagner is that all these gods are versions of himself. True. I understand that completely. So it is an irony built into this book.
Yes, and if I could just ask then in closing, as a kind of final question, as you think about the future of education, so many things are changing. We've kind of seen the collapse of traditional journalism, legacy media, and you think of the kind of world we're leaving the next generation. What would you like young people to know, preserve, and remember?
Oh God, that's endless. Well, I don't think what they should do is be nostalgic for my generation. They have to find something new. Of course, there are things that I feel very sorry about, for instance, people's addiction to smartphones and things like that. But in the end, I think the notion of nostalgia for young people, that it was, my time or Patrick's time was better than now, isn't going to serve them very well. It's an odd thing for an old person to say, but you have to go on. Your life should go on, and you shouldn't look to us for lessons of how to live.
Yes, well, these are such important insights, and thank you, Richard Sennett, for opening our minds to the performance that lies beneath art, life, politics. By recognizing the life in the concrete, we can transform our relationships, and our cities can become creative, inspiring, living works of art. We all live on one planet we call home. Thank you for adding your voice to One Planet Podcast and the creative process.
Thank you.
The Creative Process Podcast is supported by the Jan Michalski Foundation. This interview was conducted by Mia Funk and Patrick Healy, with the participation of collaborating universities and students. Associate interview producer on this episode was Sophie Garnier. The Creative Process is produced by Mia Funk. Additional production support by Katie Foster. Wintertime was composed by Nicholas Anadolis and performed by the Athenian Trio. We hope you've enjoyed listening to this podcast. If you'd like to get involved with our creative community, exhibitions, podcasts, or submit your creative works for review, just follow us on Instagram on @creativeprocesspodcast and send us a DM. Thanks for listening.